Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the aftermath of the Reverend Wright manufactured scandal, if you will, that has apparently had some impact on Barack Obama's electoral fortunes in his neck-to-neck race with Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. Obviously, Tuesday will tell with the primaries in North Carolina and Indiana. We'll be talking with John Marks, who's a former producer for 60 Minutes and a former journalist for the U.S. News and World Report. He's the author of Reasons to Believe, One Man's Journey Among the Evangelicals and the Faith He Left Behind. He's also made a documentary, Purple State of Mind. And in Reasons to Believe, John Marks reaches across sectarian lines to present the evangelical world from the inside out at a time when our country is increasingly divided over questions of faith, spirituality, and morality. And, of course, this will be in the context of it used to be, of course, this is the only democracy in the world that appears to have more interest in a candidate's sex life than their policies. And now that has become even more absurd in the extent to which apparently now one's own preacher is a factor in whether or not you can become a successful politician in this country or indeed a leader of the lone superpower. We'll also speak with John Stauber, who's an investigative writer, public speaker, and democracy advocate. He's also the founder of the nonprofit, nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy and its news magazine, PR Watch. He has co-authored six books, including the 2003 New York Times bestseller, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War in Iraq. And we'll be talking to him about the extent to which the networks, and particularly the cable networks, used Pentagon advisors who were, in fact, meeting regularly with the former Secretary of Defense and getting briefings from him. And of course, they were also in the Pentagon's revolving door with contracts, having left the military, gone straight into the military-industrial complex. And of course, to that extent, their connections with Donald Rumsfeld were critical. So we'll look into how the mainstream media have been duped for some time by these military experts who have been giving less than biased coverage of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then we'll speak with David Freeman, who will be joining us in the third section of the first hour. He is has spent his life at the forefront of energy policy. He is was the head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the New York Power, former state California energy czar. He saved California from the Enron-generated power crisis and is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, An Insider Shows How. I'm now speaking with John Marks, a former producer for 60 Minutes, a journalist with U.S. News and World Report, and the author of Reasons to Believe, One Man's Journey Among the Evangelicals and the Faith He Left Behind, as well as the companion documentary, Purple State of Mind. And as I mentioned in the opening, John Marks, that it is indeed extraordinary that we are alone among the Western democracies where we seem obsessed with the personal private lives of politicians. It's obviously important. It's a deal breaker. It almost President Clinton was almost impeached over revelations that were generated by the Republican Party. And now it's even more absurd that apparently not only is your private sex life relevant to your ability to govern, but who your preacher is equally so.
Yes, I think it's becoming an issue. I think that the extent to which the Bush administration made a core religious bloc a centerpiece of their base over the last 10 years, last 8 years, but really the way the Republican Party had mobilized that base even in the years before that, in the 90s, has all of a sudden given us an atmosphere in which now faith, like sex, is fair game, and that opens up a whole can of worms. And right now it's really hitting the Democratic Party, but I think as the race moves into the general election, you're going to see more focus on a lot of the evangelical people who might support John McCain. We've already started seeing interesting rumblings about John Hagee, a pastor in Texas, who has made very clear his negative feelings about the Roman Catholic Church in an election in which Catholic voters are going to be hugely important. So,
isn't John McCain a Catholic?
I believe he is a Catholic, but I don't think religion has ever been a centerpiece of his. It's never been a centerpiece of his political identity at all. I think he's holding his nose in courting conservative Christians. He's always enjoyed, I think, his place in the Republican Party with Democrats and with so-called swing voters because he has stayed away from that group, except for this year. So for the, and actually he attacked them when he ran in 2000. And called Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson agents of intolerance. So he has had a very combative and relationship with Protestants, with evangelical Protestants, and his Catholicism probably informs his stance on abortion, although that's not even clear. McCain is just not a candidate who is traditionally hewed to some religious party or made a big deal out of it. But he needs those voters this year. He desperately needs them to shore up a base that is anything but confident in his loyalties to them. So he has made now he has made a kind of alliance with this guy John Hagee, and although I think it's been fairly quiet in the news media so far, if you get into a general election, the Democratic Party is going to make great hay out of it for sure.
Well, it is extraordinary though that just that we're in a situation of your lunatic versus our lunatic, and I'm wondering whether there'll be any fairness in this because. We saw this week the overexposure of the Reverend Wright earlier in the week, and he certainly was, at first blush, he seemed to be, you know, not particularly controversial and seemed to be a Fox News kind of ginned up controversy. But then the more you saw him, the more you saw his unbridled ego and some of his slightly loopy ideas. But you know, that's not entirely uncommon in religious discourse. But compare the Reverend Wright, if you will, with Hagee, with the Reverend Moon, who, by the way, has been supporting Republicans for the longest time,
of course,
with enormous amounts of money, and he runs a newspaper in Washington, which is, like Fox News, a kind of a Pravda for the Republican Party. So if we get down to your lunatic versus our lunatic, who's going to win that one?
Well, that's a great question. I think that what it's going to come down to is the extent to which that population of voters who really cares about this and is really going to make a decision based on this in their voting and in the polls is going to pay more attention to, say, a Jeremiah Wright, whose rage and anger and statements touch on ultimately, and this is not to justify anything he said, but he is coming from a position of dealing with an urban church and with urban church needs, which means dealing with issues like poverty, issues like race, the disparity in incomes, along with what that means for health care and education. And so when he starts talking, he puts a particular kind of fear, anxiety, hostility into the minds of people who don't know anything about that world, don't want to know anything about that world, have very little sympathy for it, in addition to those people who simply don't hear extremism and ego mixed in a way that is off-putting. But if you figure that we're going to hear both, that's going to be there in both Hagee and in Reverend Wright, then on the Hagee side of the equation, you're going to start hearing, you know, things that are much more the bailiwick of the evangelical church, anti-Catholicism. For instance, also there's this statement he's made about Katrina basically hitting New Orleans as a result of a gay parade that was scheduled for that Monday. So that kind of crazy talk is every bit as incendiary as anything Jeremiah Wright has said, and that's going to immediately raise all the specters about the conservative Christian right and their agenda in this country for people who are sort of moderate to left-leaning. But, you know, so in each case, what's striking to me is that these are both figures who deal in language that is relatively marginal most of the time, and now all of a sudden, and neither of them really address sort of the central universal issues that are affecting most mainstream voters. And yet because of the tie between religion and politics, all of a sudden because that has become so central to the political conversation, they're going to be a factor. I don't think McCain for 1 minute would endorse anything that Hagee says on the subject of Katrina and New Orleans, and I'm certain, and he has already rejected what he said about Catholicism and the Roman Catholic Church, and Obama's made quite clear that he does not agree with what Jeremiah Wright's saying. But it's almost as if, you know, we've turned up to mistresses here. And no matter what else these candidates say, they are now, they have these two characters who are part of their baggage. And there's no going back. I don't think you can put, in both cases, I think you're going to find that these will be around to stay.
I never had religious discourse with that minister. Wagging
right,
your finger.
Beautiful, right?
It's becoming so absurd. I mean, does anybody want to pull back and really ask the question of whether you are the sins of the father are visited upon you if your rabbi says something stupid or inflammatory, if your preacher and priest? I've heard some of the strangest things from the pulpit. But that's a part of the price you pay for entering the church or the synagogue, isn't it?
Well, here's the good news. It is the price you pay, and the good news is that the possibility that exists that both McCain and, say, the candidate is Obama, will understand that each one of their kind of ministerial problems, so to speak, will cancel each other out, and they both can make the case that, let's rise above this. Now, that might not happen, and advisors may counsel otherwise, but certainly Obama, I think he will try to make the case that, you know, we got to put this behind us. He will list all the things that are really facing this country. You know, there are times it occurs to me that Americans, by and large, have this feeling that they don't have much to worry about, even when they're worried about their mortgage and they know they have these problems. When you get in these election cycles where these marginal kind of small potatoes issues somehow get blown up to gigantic proportion, it's almost as if something in the psyche of the American voter says, you know what, really and truly, this is what matters. This kind of minor stuff, this is really what I should be concerned about. This is what interests me and entertains me right now. And all those concerns and problems I have, you know, those real problems about will I keep my house? Will I have a job? Will we still be in a war in Iraq? Will we still be trying to find bin Laden in Afghanistan? All those things suddenly fade because in some part of the psyche, Americans don't take their own problems as seriously as they should when it comes to the voting process. To me, it's a very weird disconnect. I can't honestly claim to understand it, except that, you know, religion and sex are these two things that come, and sex originally, but now religion, seem to have to occupy a greater ground during these election cycles than they do at any other time in the course of American life.
Well, is it generated by the political culture, or is it propagated by the press?
A little bit of both. I think it's a little bit of both. I think, you know, there's no doubt that this country, among the developed countries, has more religion in its DNA than certainly any European country, certainly more than Japan. It's just something that is a huge part of life, but it doesn't, when people are worried about their pocketbook, supposedly they're not supposed to be worried about this so much. They're not supposed to be so concerned. I mean, Obama, when he made that comment in San Francisco about, you know, bitter small-town Americans clinging to guns and religion, he was sort of implying, you know, they're doing that because they've been disappointed economically. I'm not so sure that that's right. Something about this religious side of the American character is almost inscrutable. My partner in the documentary Purple State of Mind, Craig Detweiler, who's an evangelical Christian and who talks a lot about this in the movie, essentially says, you know, the reason that we have so much religion in our public life and our public discourse is because religious faith was never actually mandated in the Constitution. It was a matter of free choice, and that free choice has given a vitality to religious life in this country that has vanished from other parts of the world where at one time or another there was a state religion to go along with the government. I'm not so sure if that's the whole case, but I think part of it is that religious life is what we have by and large throughout this country as an alternative to our commerce and the way we spend our time making money and doing business, which is the real preoccupation, I think, of most Americans. The alternative to that, for most people in this country is some kind of religious connection.
Well, but in some of the evangelical churches, those two are connected in a very overt way with these kind of preachers / motivational speakers. Absolutely. Like the Reverend Osteen down there in Dallas. God doesn't want you to be a whiner. God wants you to be a winner.
That's right.
It's total. Who's the chiclet teeth guy? Tony Robbins. So that seems to be a big part of a lot of the evangelical stuff that.
It's true. The health, wealth, and prosperity movement, which basically says God wants you to be rich, God wants you to be prosperous. Right. That is, there's a definite hybrid that has occurred, and it's actually being exported around the world. It's a classically American formulation of God's on your side, and if God's on your side, you should be making money. And if you're
right,
and
if but you, conversely, if God's not on your side, and you're poor, it's your own fault.
It's your own fault, exactly. Although, of course, in this country, there's also there's sort of churches all over this country that completely reject that. That's a certain strain that is very strong, and it has an instantaneous appeal to Americans who are already, tend to feel that commerce must be good in every way. And then the church comes along and says, not only is it good, it's ordained by God, but you do have this sort of a lot of people in the evangelical world even who reject that. And who reject what's happened with, the melding of the evangelical church with the Republican Party and with pro-business principles there to the exclusion of everything else. I would say that while it is very much a strand in the church, it's also there's a conflicted part of it, which, and this really came out with Katrina. All of a sudden, Christians mobilized to help the people in Katrina who were on the ground and saw, churches were the first responders to that crisis. And this is in my book. There's a chapter I devote to it because I think it's significant that people didn't sort of, the churches didn't make judgments about race. They didn't make judgments about who was coming. They didn't make judgments about who was poor, who was wealthy. They basically opened their doors and they let all these people in. Some of them certainly used the opportunity to proselytize the people coming out of New Orleans. But I spoke with many of them who just kind of rejected that out of hand, and also rejected out of hand those statements by people like Hagee, and others who
and
said,
Falwell,
you know,
and Robinson.
Coming.
Well, Falwell and Robinson, I think, also at 9/11 said that the lesbians were responsible for 9/11.
Right, exactly. I mean, there is that kind of strain is, part of what I'm arguing in my book is that there's a generation of preachers and conservative activists who use that kind of language and held those beliefs that are fading in terms of their influence. It's a generational thing. Falwell has already left us. Robertson's getting on in years. And the fire and brimstone and, God's judging all you sinners, that is a language that's becoming increasingly embarrassing to large numbers of evangelical Christians. And I think that's also coming along with a shift in how evangelicals see their relationship to political parties. So, you get a Huckabee, and Mike Huckabee comes along, and he is not the choice of the conservative establishment, but he becomes the choice of many evangelicals because he's actually more biblically oriented. He actually is clearly one of them, unlike John McCain, but he's also talking big government, and because he's focusing on questions of poverty, he's focusing on education, he actually wants more arts education in the schools, and that's all in the context of him being a kind of ideal candidate if all you're looking at is religion. But many figures on the conservative Christian right rejected him because they didn't think he could win, for one, and for two, he didn't sound appropriately conservative. So that's a real conflict in the ranks of these organizations.
But it shows you that these televangelists are more interested in power than principle.
Yes, at least. Many of them are. There's no doubt about it.
John Marks, again, is a former producer for 60 Minutes and former journalist for U.S. News and World Report, and the author of Reasons to Believe, One Man's Journey Among the Evangelicals and the Faith He Left Behind, and a companion documentary that he made traveling around the country with a friend who goes back to the days when you were in seminary together, right?
Actually, we were at a school called Davidson College. It is, it's not religious, but we were both religious. We were born-again Christians.
And you strayed and he stayed.
Yes, exactly. Well put.
So we
made a documentary to talk about that, the choices we made.
Well, tell me, though, about the purple state idea, because it's hard to envision a purple state now that we have such a partisan moment here. And there's obviously even more partisanship on the Democratic side than the Republican side in terms of the choices they have to make. The key state in at the moment appears to be Indiana,
yes.
Which I think is a by all definitions a purple state, right?
Yes, I mean, I think it's got everyone's there, all the different subcultures and groups, and it's interesting that, you know, the Democrats are going to have to duke it out there before the Republicans and Democrats do, and there's an attempt to obviously drive a wedge. The Clinton campaign, I think, has done a pretty good job of making sure that, you know, Indiana voters feel that she's the one who's in the corner of the blue collar, and she's the one who's kind of backing the hardworking, real, ordinary American people, and Barack Obama is the guy who's coming in as the elitist, who is out of touch. Whether or not any of that will fly, we'll see on Tuesday. But I think the purple state idea is really that, you know, we are going to disagree in this country. We are going to have different solutions to our problems. We are going to disagree about abortion. We're going to disagree about gay marriage. We're going to disagree about all kinds of things. And that the language of the partisan debate has become so poisonous and also so trivialized. I mean, one only needs to look at the ABC News debates of a few weeks ago when all the questions were about sort of the little gaffes that the candidates had made, and very little of it focused on the major policy issues that really most Americans probably do care about, but maybe, you know, are encouraged to forget in the face of this smaller stuff. That atmosphere of rancor and vilification and take no prisoners approach, you know, helped along by people like Karl Rove, and now obviously in the campaigns on the Democratic side. To my friend Craig Detweiler and myself, we just thought, well, we disagree about religion. That's our great divide. I don't believe in God. He does. He's lived his life following Jesus, and I've lived my life not following Jesus and following, you know, my own lights and being a professional journalist and a part of the horrible, you know, much despised mainstream media. So we thought, okay, we differ about these things, but we have to try to keep this bond because the bond matters to us. So how do we talk about these things that separate us? For instance, he's pro-life on the abortion issue. I'm pro-choice. We attempt to cross that barrier, and we're very modest in our ambitions. All we wanted to do was see, can we do it? And by putting it on film, we hoped that we might encourage others to find that neighbor next door or find that family member across the dinner table and say, look, you know, we're both human beings. We're both Americans. We both have plenty of things here in common if we'd only acknowledge them. Now let's talk about the things that we vehemently disagree about. Obviously, this is not a model for what's happening in Congress, and I don't think it's much of a model for what's happening in the media. But to me, it seemed like a very small thing I could do to try to explore for myself what is possible in terms of dialogue.
Well, just in closing, it's interesting, though, that if you look at what Obama's saying on the stump speeches, and particularly in Indiana, he's saying exactly what you're saying, which is that he thinks that the media have trivialized the race, that the American people care about solutions and they care about coming together, and they're sick of partisanship. So all of the things that you're just saying is essentially Obama's stump speech, but yet the media and Hillary Clinton have managed to paint him in the corner of, as you pointed out, an elitist and possibly even a secretly disloyal American who might even be a stealth Muslim.
Yes, of course. Not wearing the flag pin is the giveaway there. It's the smoking gun. I think that this is true, and I think that, you know, but I think the truth is that if this idea is to have any traction at all, Obama has to face exactly this kind of thing. I mean, he's making the argument as an argument for not just a new way of political dialogue, but a new way of government. And so if he's going to succeed, he's going to bear the brunt of the worst that the current political culture can throw at him. And the big question is he going to succumb to that political culture, which at times it seems like he might, or is he going to overcome it and actually not only sort of give us an example for a new kind of politics, but also, you know, try to govern that way? And I think it's a massive question. I wish I had a lot of confidence that it can happen. And part of me thinks, well, this is an undertaking that's huge, and it's not going to happen in this election cycle. But maybe the point is the conversation has started, and perhaps the disgust will grow, and we'll see some evolution in this direction over time. I'd love to believe that we are at the turning point now, but when I look at what's happening in the Clinton-Obama campaign, I think, no, I'm just not sure that the country's there yet. I think the country is bracing itself for another absolutely vicious, down-and-dirty political campaign that focuses on sex and now God to the exclusion of everything that people have to make their decisions on based on.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, John Marks.
Ian, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with John Marks, a former producer for 60 Minutes and a former journalist for US News and World Report and the author of a new book, Reasons to Believe, One Man's Journey Among the Evangelicals and the Faith He Left Behind, as well as producing a companion documentary, Purple State of Mind. I'm now speaking with John Stauber, who's an investigative writer, public speaker, and democracy advocate. He's also the founder of the nonprofit Nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy and its news magazine, PR Watch. He's co-authored 6 books, including the 2003 New York Times bestseller, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War on Iraq. And I saw you, and of course you were advising a number of organizations, including the Center for Food Safety, Iraq Veterans Against the War, and the Media Education Foundation. I saw you, John, on the NewsHour recently talking about the scandal that the New York Times broke on the front page of how most of the talking heads, the generals that were trucked out to buy both the networks and the cable networks to discuss the Iraq war as experts, in quote, were in fact being briefed by then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and many of them had revolving door consulting jobs with the Pentagon, and obviously to that extent they were currying favor with the Secretary of Defense and carrying his water. What was extraordinary about the your appearance on the NewsHour was, one, they couldn't get anybody. The NewsHour couldn't get anybody to go on from the Pentagon or from the news organizations. And the guy that you debated was a former, the ABC's former defense correspondent. And he seemed to be so hopelessly out of touch with reality that it made me feel like the embedding is complete. They are completely in bed.
Well, Ian, thanks for having me on this program. And today it's 2 weeks since the New York Times broke this 2-year investigation and exposed that the Pentagon, since 2002, has had this team of propagandists, 75 military analysts recruited personally by the Department of Defense to be their message surrogates embedded inside the TV networks. Today it's 2 weeks since that story broke, and my appearance a week ago Thursday on the NewsHour that you described, debating former ABC correspondent Bob Zelnick, is still the only story that has appeared on mainstream national TV news about this scandal. And of course, the reason for that is pretty obvious. This is a scandal where all the major commercial networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, were complicit and were duped into being the vehicles for these Pentagon analysts. As you point out, it's bad enough that all those networks felt they had to put retired military people, most of whom are lobbyists and consultants to military contracting corporations, on their payroll. But we now know that the real scandal that it took place, and took place right up to now, this program has only been temporarily suspended, is that 75 of them were working hand-in-hand with the Department of Defense and were message surrogates, delivering the message of the Department of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, Tory Clark, the head of propaganda for the Department of Defense. They weren't in any sense objective. And, of course, our tax dollars paid for this and paid for their trips to Iraq and Guantanamo. And the good news is that the independent media, alternative media, the blogosphere, and media watchdogs like editor and publisher are not letting go of this. And just last Friday, some 36 members of Congress sent a letter to the Department of Defense Inspector General calling for an investigation, which is exactly what we need.
Well, but there's a, just as much as there's a revolving door in the Pentagon between the senior brass and flag officers who end up consulting for defense contracts, that's a given, that's a norm. There appears also to be a revolving door with the media. For example, Pete Williams, who was a Pentagon spokesman, is now an NBC correspondent. You mentioned Tori Clark, who was also a Pentagon spokesperson, but Rumsfeld's PR flack, Dan Senor, he's married to Campbell Brown, who's now with CNN.
Yeah, it's just shameless, and the networks are so powerful. That's where most Americans, unfortunately, get most of their news. So they feel clearly that they can go ahead and hire these military flacks and pay them to be on-air analysts, and no one will really notice if they don't blow the whistle on themselves. And that's what's going on with their stonewalling, refusing to look at their involvement in this Pentagon military analyst program. Last week, the press flack for the White House, Perino, was forced finally to answer a question about this, and obviously that provided one more opportunity, as if any were needed, for these so-called journalists in the mainstream news media networks to pick up on that and report it. I mean, my goodness, the White House is having to field a question about this program, and that wasn't national news either. So we really see how the propaganda works here. The mainstream media, that the TV networks in particular, who refuse to stand up to the administration and question their false claims about the necessity for war, and who censored out of their coverage leading to the attack on Iraq and since critics of the war, are now keeping this Pentagon propaganda program in which they're complicit from their audience also.
So none of these guys that were in the New York Times story have ever made an apology, or they've never been on doing their pitching for the Pentagon, or allegedly giving analytical insight. They have neither been asked nor have they volunteered to talk about this.
Well, some of them did talk candidly with the New York Times and condemned what they had participated in. A few of them did, like Ken Allard from NBC. So, you know, there are people who were in the program who now regret it and are ashamed of it, and spoke accordingly to David Barstow when he broke this in the Times 2 weeks ago. So there are people that could be directly interviewed who I think would talk and condemn the program. I mean, Ken Allard, who was a former NBC military analyst who taught information warfare at the National Defense University, called it PSYOPs on steroids. He participated in it, and now he's ashamed of it. So, you know, we've seen some of the others say, oh, you know, this wasn't a propaganda program, and that's all I'm going to say. But the real problem here is the power of the TV networks to be duped this way and then not even cover this extremely important program, because this propaganda is illegal. It's clearly illegal. As I said on the NewsHour, going back to the 1920s, there have been federal laws passed saying that the U.S. government shall not propagandize its citizenry, and every single appropriations that Congress passes has boilerplate language attached to that effect. If money is going to be expended to propagandize the American people, that actually has to be stated in the appropriations to make it okay. Of course, you or I can't sue, unfortunately. Somebody who had their leg blown off in Iraq because of this propaganda can't sue. The remedial action has to come through the Department of Justice or via congressional action. And as I said on the NewsHour, this is just one more example of the horrendous propaganda that it took to sell the war that our tax dollars paid for and that needs to be fully investigated.
Well, when anybody tries to prick that bubble, I recall when MoveOn.org did that ad prior to the time before last that General Petraeus testified, and of course General Petraeus, is testifying instead of George W. Bush. George W. Bush is the architect of this war. He's yet to explain what it's about, but he's still the architect. And he hides behind these generals because he says, well, you know, whatever the generals say is okay by me. So in a sense, he abdicates his responsibility as commander-in-chief, trying to get it both ways here. But, Petraeus, for example, apparently that was General Petraeus was actually that was coined by his own men in the 82nd Airborne. So, you know, it's not exactly news in military circles. And apparently any time you ever actually talk to the troops in Iraq, they all think it's a complete catastrophe and they all want to get the hell out of there. You know, so there's something going on here that they've managed this thing. Not only from the very beginning did they manage this as a totally censored war, where on Al Jazeera, BBC, any other network, you could see what was really happening in Iraq in terms of particularly the civilian casualties, but you can't see that over here. So you have to put this in a broader context to the extent to which the American people have accepted censorship and propaganda.
Yeah, and it really goes all the way back to Vietnam when many people in government who were advocates and executors of the war in Vietnam decided that the biggest problem was that the news media was conveying to the American people a fairly honest view of what was happening in Vietnam. I remember being in high school then and being incredibly disturbed and becoming anti-war, watching American soldiers burning down villages, rounding up women and children, indiscriminately dropping napalm on civilians. Of course, we now know that over 2 million Asian civilians were killed by that war. But if you talk with the advocates of war, the real problem there was the American people got a chance to see how the war was being waged. And ever since then, the Pentagon and whichever administration is in power has used more and more effective propaganda to control what Americans see about the war, and you can see the surge itself as being an incredibly effective propaganda tool. It's reduced news media coverage of the war by some 75% or more, and it's really accomplished nothing in terms of bringing some sort of closure to American involvement closer to hand, but it's functioned tremendously well to move the war out of the front pages. And we have a real problem in this country with the fact that our mainstream media lines up behind whatever any administration decides to do in U.S. foreign policy and see itself not as a watchdog or a critic, but as sort of a cheerleader and a propagandist for the Pentagon. And nothing could make that more clear than this Pentagon military analyst program.
And John Stabber, the wall that you talked about that is erected between to prevent any government money from being used to propagandize the American people. That's, for example, why the U.S. Information Agency, who do a lot of overseas propagandizing on behalf of America, and they make films and publications, etc. None of those are allowed to be shown here in the United States.
Right.
So it works, but I'm trying to get a handle on what is this law and why isn't it being used to clean house at the Pentagon and at the networks?
Well, the law you specifically referenced is the 1948 Smith-Mundt Act, but every appropriations bill passed by Congress since 1951 contains this language and restriction, quote, "No part of any appropriation contained in this or any other act shall be used for publicity or propaganda purposes within the United States, not heretofore authorized by Congress." So we've got the laws on the books, and this program as, taxpayer-funded covert propaganda is clearly illegal. The problem is that the remedy is through the Department of Justice or through the Congress. Individual citizens can't sue. No one under the law can bring, for instance, a class action suit from the American people saying, hey, we have been consistently propagandized and misled about this war. We want our money back. That's why we have to make we have to take advantage. We, the American people, have to take advantage of this opportunity to force Congress to fully investigate the propaganda that sold this war. Because what happens is, if these laws are ignored, and they are being ignored, and no one pays a price, the propaganda just continues. And unless propagandists in the Bush administration and the Pentagon who lied us into this war are held accountable, we can expect the same thing in Iran in 6 months or wherever the next preemptive use of military force by the United States might occur.
So just in closing, John Stabber, what's in the bill that the 37 Congress people have put forth to try and clean up this loophole, which is clearly not even a loophole now? It's apparently the way, that's the norm, that all these guys you basically see are propagandists, not independent analysts.
Yeah, it's not at the point of legislation yet, but Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and 36 other members of Congress on Friday sent a long letter to the Inspector General of the Department of Defense asking specifically for answers to six questions and demanding a further investigation. And anyone who goes to PRWatch.org, Public Relations Watch, PRWatch.org, our website, can scroll down and find a link to that out of one of our numerous reports on this issue.
Well, it's extraordinary that that thing that I saw you on the news hour is the only time that anybody's covered the aftermath of the New York Times breaking this 2-year-long investigative story.
That's right. That is the only national television news story that has appeared on this entire issue. Not only did ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and the Pentagon refuse to put anyone on McNeil Lair to debate me, on the PBS NewsHour to debate me, none of those networks have even run a program. Brian Williams of NBC defended this propaganda program in his online blog, for instance, but NBC...
Well, what in God's name did he say that defended it? I mean, just quickly...
Well, basically what they're saying is, hey, this is no big deal. These military analysts certainly wouldn't just repeat Pentagon propaganda. And
well, they did. They met with Rumsfeld. He gave them their talking points, and he made sure they got contracts. I mean, what more can... Oh, God.
Well, that's what happens when you're able to control the message by not covering the story. Mm-hmm. Brian Williams, rather than covering it on the NBC National News, misrepresents it on his blog.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, John Stabber.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with John Stabber, investigative writer, public speaker, democracy advocate. He's also the founder of the nonprofit, nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy and its news magazine, PR Watch. I'm now speaking with David Freeman, who spent his life at the forefront of energy policy. He was the head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and as the former state of California energy czar, he saved California from the Enron Iran-generated power crisis. He's also the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, An Insider Shows How. And this Tuesday, May the 6th, at the Hammer Museum in Westwood at 7 p.m., I'll be hosting an important discussion entitled Energy Independence, A Dire Need or a Dangerous Delusion. And David Freeman will be debating Robert Bryce at that venue. I encourage you all to come. It's free and open to the public. And David Freeman, with a $4 a gallon gasoline now being the norm, both John McCain and Hillary Clinton are calling for a gas tax holiday, which every economist, I think, in the country, if not the world, has referred to as being an absurd gimmick. Yet, apparently, the public, perhaps, I'm not sure, but the public looks as if it's buying it.
Well, this is absolutely the worst possible signal to send to the American people. I'm really embarrassed for the both of them, and I am discouraged. What the candidates for president should be saying is that this high-energy civilization of ours is on death row, and that unless we use less oil and less coal and less nuclear power, we're on a dead-end road. The very idea of sending a signal that gas guzzling as usual is the American dream is appalling. The substance of it is bad enough, but the message is just terrible. This is a time when we ought to be telling the American people the truth, that there's going to have to be some belt tightening and some sacrificing in this transition from operating on three poisons, coal, oil, and nuclear, to renewable energy. And the idea that we ought to eliminate taxes in this country, which are a small pittance of the kind of taxes that are charged in Europe, is appalling. We have to be conserving and use. I mean, if you wanted to do anything, it would be something the economists would all oppose, and that is to enact a freeze on gas prices. I mean, what Hillary and McCain are suggesting just leaves the oil companies free to raise the prices even more, and the taxes money, instead of going to the federal government, would go to them, and they get richer and richer. This is insane.
Well, apparently, with these vast windfalls that the oil companies are getting, with ExxonMobil having record profits and now Chevron as well, and Unocal announcing record profits, I understand that what ExxonMobil is doing with these excess profits is buying up their stock.
Well, they're buying up America in a sense. An excess profits tax would be a reasonable thing to propose at this time. But if you really wanted to play hardball, let's just freeze retail price of gasoline for the next 6 months. I'm not in favor of that, but if you're going to start tinkering with the marketplace and want to help consumers, now, that might create a shortage, and that might really bring this issue to the attention of the American people in an unmistakable manner. We have got to wake up because we're in deadly peril because of our dependence on oil. Even McCain said it the other day, that we're over there in Iraq because of oil. Now, do we want to use more and more so we're stuck over there deeper? I mean, this... This is a form of insanity that's going on.
Well, but it's worse than that in a sense, because all the money that the price of oil being over $100 a barrel, many people, analysts suggest that at least a third of that or a quarter of that is what they call the fear premium and the extent to which the market is being gamed. And, of course, you obviously know a lot about that since you were the state of California energy czar.
OPEC is alive and well, folks.
Well, that's the point I was going to make, is that OPEC's alive and well because all this money is going into these sovereign funds, which these countries like the Arab Gulf countries and Venezuela and Russia are then putting that money back into the oil commodities market, which has the effect of driving up the price of oil. And many analysts say that one of the reasons why they're doing that is it's a hedge against the falling dollar.
So that's right. One of the reasons that the price of oil is higher is that the value of the dollar is lower. That plus the fear factor.
And running up the market.
The cost of pumping oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia hadn't gone up a nickel. The price has gone up from $20 to $120. Now, you don't have to be an economist to figure out who's getting rich and who's getting poor.
Well, do you think that at any point in this election cycle, the American public will be treated as adults instead of these silly gimmicks, which apparently the McCain-Clinton gas tax holiday will amount to half a tank of gas for everybody in the country
over
the summer?
We can say, be encouraged that at least Barack Obama hasn't drunk the Kool-Aid and is showing some political courage and not jumping on that apparently ridiculous but popular gimmick that's being thrown out.
But when you say it's popular, does that mean that at the end of the day, the American people are more interested in getting gas? And at this point, it looks like they're used to this price because for the longest time, apparently, the Saudis were very concerned about running the price up too much because that would then...
they've gotten over it, my friend. They've gotten
clearly,
over it.
Clearly, they're getting used to $100-plus dollar a barrel, and they like
they've
it that way.
They've overcome that principle in
When are we going to overcome it, in other words?
Well, we need some leaders that will tell the truth. I mean, I don't blame the American people. If you listen to what they've been told on energy, they have not been asked to do anything that comes close to sacrifice, not in this whole 6 years of war. So obviously, if one person tells them, you know, we'll reduce your price, and no one is explaining that that's counterproductive, it's on the surface a bit popular. I'm just hoping that after the election's over, that someone will become an adult.
Well, at this point, there's anger, but it seems to be sort of inchoate, and it doesn't seem to be directed. And one of the things that I find extraordinary is that the one thing that I think a politician could get through to the public and make it resonate is the dysfunctional nature of our transportation system vis-a-vis gasoline, because you're paying $4 a gallon for this gas, but guess what? You spend about 2 hours a day in gridlock. This stuff, putting it up into the atmosphere, it's so broken at a fundamental level that I would have thought that some people would be talking about not just the excessive costs of gas, but also the excessive waste in terms of gridlock.
Well, the message to the American people should be that we need to have a transportation system that's run on renewable energy in the form of electricity. We need to electrify the railroads, and we need to stop building more highways and building the 21st century version of railroads with maglev or other new technologies that are being deployed, interesting enough, in places like Shanghai, but not in the United States of America. The candidates are just misleading the American people with this gas tax gimmick, because what should be laid out is a green jobs program of enormous proportion that will amount to the second industrial revolution. We have got to get off of oil and as quickly as we can, and off of coal as quickly as we can, or we're going to be witnessing the melting of most of the ice on Earth and the rising of the oceans and climate change, the likes of which we can't possibly imagine. And we're in a fight for our lives, and the next 10 years are crucial. And what's so discouraging is rather than a call for a green revolution, we're getting gimmicks that run counter to what the revolution needs to be.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, David Freeman, just to discuss the silliness of all the lack of a serious debate about the biggest issue of all that's facing this country, which is energy independence. And again, David Freeman will be at the Hammer Museum this Tuesday, May the 6th at 7 p.m., I'll be conducting a forum there on energy independence, a dire need or a dangerous delusion. David Freeman, of course, spent his life at the forefront of energy policy. He was the head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the New York Power, and former State of California Energy Czar who saved California from the Enron-generated power crisis. He'll be debating. He's also got a book, Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how he'll be debating Robert Bryce, the managing editor of the Houston-based newsletter Energy Tribune. He's also a contributing writer to the Texas Observer and the Saudi Business newspaper El Ekatish. I'm sorry about that. I can't pronounce it. And he's the author of Gusher of Lies, A Dangerous Delusion of Energy Independence. So do come. It's open, free to the public. I expect you all to show up to have a real discussion, the one that the presidential candidates aren't having. Would you agree, David?
Oh, yeah. We'll have a good old time.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. By the way, there's a correction here. John McCain is not a Catholic. He joined the Baptists in early 2000. Previously, he was an Episcopalian. Well, I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Dewan, the assistant producer, and Jazz Shepherd, the engineer.